All right, thank you everyone for your patience. We'll go ahead and get started. So if you're on this webinar today, it's because you're interested in the Scholar in Residence program and an opportunity to bring a visiting scholar to your campus. This webinar is geared towards rural colleges and universities, so that is who we will be gearing this webinar to. However, if you're coming from outside that scope of institution, we still welcome you to join today, and we hope you will still find this information useful. As a quick note, my name is Sarah Causer. I'm an Outreach and Recruitment Specialist here at IIE based in our Houston, Texas office. Today I'm joined by a lovely panel that I would like to also introduce. The first one is Kaylee Atwater. Kaylee, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, sure. Thanks, Sarah. My name is Kaylee Atwater. I am a placement advisor here at IIE. I'm in the DC office. And I work on placements, and I work with the host institutions for the Scholar in Residence program, and it's wonderful to work with. And I also work with a few other programs here at IIE, too.
Perfect. Next, I would like to introduce David Levin, who is the Senior Program Manager at the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. David, would you like to say hello?
Sure. Sarah, thanks very much, and thank you all for tuning in. I have the pleasure of working on a number of Fulbright programs here at the State Department, and I'm also the Diversity Coordinator for the Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs.
Great. And last but certainly not least, we'd like to introduce Amanda Enriquez from Northwest College, who is serving as our alumni host for this webinar. Amanda, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes. Hi, everyone. My name is Amanda Enriquez, and it's an absolute honor to be here today. My title is Intercultural Program Manager, and I work at a small rural community college in Powell, Wyoming. So I think that kind of fits the description pretty nicely, and we've had some great opportunities through Fulbright and also some challenges that have come with it, and I really look forward to talking to everyone about those.
Great. Thank you so much, Amanda. I know we're all thrilled to have you here and offering your perspective a little bit later on into the session. As a quick note, I just want to highlight a few features. A few of you already used the question and chat feature to submit and tell me that you could hear me. So throughout the presentation, please feel free to submit questions. We will actually have a devoted time at the end of this presentation to answer any and all questions. And as a second note, this session is being recorded. So after we end today, we will be archiving this session, and I will make sure to email it out to you so you can listen to this again and again if you so desire. But with that, we will get started. So as I already said, we're giving a quick overview today of the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program. We'll include some programmatic insights from the State Department's perspective as far as trends within the program, as well as the number of grants awarded per year and overall insights that we have seen. We will then segue into discussing the Scholar in Residence application components and the available tools we have for you, and then we'll follow it up with insight from Amanda about her institution's experience with the FAR program. Lastly, we'll briefly discuss any other opportunities within this program, as well as wrap up with a quick Q&A. So as I said, feel free to submit any questions throughout this presentation. So jumping right in, as you may or may not have noticed, there's a kind of a new logo surrounding the Fulbright Scholar programs in general. As part of that, we really want to highlight what we're really excited with our new logo and our new brand, but to also remind you that our mission and goals have not changed on the whole. So really, the mission of Fulbright is to connect people to people. That's really at the heart of the program. So in partnership with 160 countries worldwide, we offer faculty, administrators, artists, journalists, lawyers, and other professionals from all backgrounds an unparalleled opportunity to study, teach, or conduct research. So the program that you're hearing about today is about bringing a visiting scholar to your campus to teach on your campus. So again, our mission really has not changed. It is to foster that mutual understanding between people, advance knowledge across communities, and improve lives around the world. As a brief history of the program, it was established in 1946 by Congress. It is the government's flagship International Education and Cultural Exchange Program, and we're so very excited to continue to offer these slate of programs to you as institutions. The program itself is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State with funding provided by the U.S. government, and it is administered by the Institute of International Education, and we're very excited to continue on with this partnership. Continuing on, as you may have seen in past presentations, diversity is always at the forefront of our program. So we're always trying to ensure that these programs reflect the diversity of the United States society and societies abroad. So one of the things that we are very happy about, especially with programs like the Scholar Residence Program, is it actually gives opportunities to institutions that might have been underrepresented within the program in the past. So we really like that we can gear this program to institutions like yours. Diversity, we do look at it in the broadest sense, and as you can see on this screen. So moving on to the Scholar and Resident Program as a whole, the SIR program is a wonderful opportunity for you as a host institution to bring scholars and faculty members from overseas to your campus. Traditionally, these campuses may not, that we're trying to gear this program towards, might not have the opportunity to host scholars, or they potentially don't have a strong international presence. This program helps you with internationalizing your campus and develop an exchange course moving forward. These scholars primarily teach at the undergraduate academic level, and they're on your campus for either a semester or a full academic year. You really decide what your institution is looking for and what your institution needs. The program provides a cross-cultural international perspective for the campus, and the application is made by the interested U.S. institution. So that would be you guys on your campus submitting the application. While there are about 900 Fulbright Visiting Scholars on campuses in the United States around the year, what really sets this program apart, aside from the fact that you as an institution are driving the process, is that these scholars are highly integrated into your campus and community lives. These scholars are teaching full course loads and should be engaging within the campus culture. Perhaps it's advising student groups, advising students on their courses, attending different events across the campus. They really should just be highly integrated into these campus cultures. Oftentimes, these scholars are viewed as all stars, and they tend to be more visible than other visiting scholars who might often be stuck in a research lab and less exposed to the wider campus community. The application did open in March, and it has a deadline of November 1st. So that's one of the first new things you'll see with this program. In past years, we had an earlier deadline, but we did hear a lot of feedback, and we decided let's push it back till November and make sure that once you get back on campus in fall, you have enough time to work with each other and make sure to submit a very competitive application. There we go. So with that, we will continue to move on with the presentation, and I will actually pass the reins over to David, if I can get the slide to move forward, to discuss the program benefits and how it can help you increase mutual understanding and globalization on your campus. David, would you like to take over?
Sure, Sarah, thanks very much. And as Sarah has mentioned, this program is unique in a number of ways. The core visiting Fulbright Scholar Program, as Sarah talked about, is primarily researchers, 900 of them across the United States. This is very different. The biggest difference is that you as an institution are the one making the application to bring the scholar to campus as opposed to the individual scholar. And secondly, the primary focus of this program is teaching, often at the undergraduate level, primarily at the undergraduate level. Sarah talked about the kinds of things the scholar does. We sort of view this as three legs of the stool. So they're teaching courses and they're engaged in curriculum. They're also engaged across campus so that they interact with students and faculty and administrators beyond just the course of their teaching. And then the third leg of the stool is they're engaged in the community around campus, perhaps K-12 school districts, perhaps involved with local media, maybe there's a local museum, other kinds of things that gets them engaged with the local community and helps build the concept of international understanding within the community as well. So it's it really is a different kind of program. It's geared toward your needs and interests, and it's really designed, in a sense, to help you internationalize your curriculum, your campus, your community, and hopefully once that grant is over, you then also think about ways that you can sustain that relationship with that scholar's home country, and the kinds of things that the scholar brought to your campus. How are you thinking about ways that you might continue some of those efforts?
Perfect. Thanks so much, David. So speaking to the types of institutions we have geared the program towards, you can see them on your screen. You guys are coming from that rural college and university perspective, and that's who we're gearing this presentation to. But across the board, we're really looking to engage with institutions such as minority-serving institutions, small liberal arts, community colleges, so on and so forth. So you guys are really at the heart of this program, and we're so excited to see this interest continuing across the United States, especially within rural colleges. If your institution and you're listening to this webinar or this recording exists outside these parameters in the scope, we still encourage you to apply. However, we would encourage you to partner with another local institution in your area. So perhaps there is a local community college just down the road that you can partner with that you either split up the semesters and one of you has the scholar in the fall while the second institution has it in the spring, or perhaps they're close enough that they could teach a Monday, Wednesday course on one campus, a Friday course on the other. Again, it's kind of like a design your own Fulbright, what you're looking for. So these are just a few of the ideas that we have for this program. So taking the list on the previous screen, just breaking it out, we wanted to show you the FIR grants from the last active year for the 2018-2019 year. So as you are aware, we are recruiting for 2020-2021. But so the last year that was finishing up is depicted on this screen. So as of right now, rural colleges and universities are sitting at about 3%, but we do hope to see this number grow in forthcoming years, and hopefully we can work with you to add yourself to this pie chart. Before I do move on and pass the reins to Kaylee, David, I just wanted to see if you had any other trends that you want to advise to these rural colleges and universities on this phone call and where you think the program might be going.
Sure. I think the point I'd like to make, and Sarah references the 3%, for the last 2 years, we had said on the application guidelines, in addition to the kinds of schools that were given preference, we also said that rural colleges and universities are encouraged to apply. We changed that this year. We, in a sense, upgraded it just to not simply say that, but actually to include rural colleges and universities as one of the target groups. So I think what that means is that 3% should grow. And with rural colleges now sort of a full-fledged priority group within the other, like the other groups on the slide that Sarah had referenced, we hope that means that we see more of you applying. And we hope that means that we see more of you ultimately getting grants and hosting scholars.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks so much, David. So with that concludes my first portion of this session. I'm actually going to pass the reins over to Kaylee, who will take you through the application component.
All right. Thanks, Sarah. And hello again, everyone. I'm Kaylee Atwater, again in our DC office here with IIE. And since we really do want to focus today's session around hearing from Amanda a little bit later on, I'll run a bit more quickly through some of these sections. But a quick note on webinars is that in a few weeks, actually, we'll be having a webinar where I'll actually be walking through the application. So I definitely encourage you to join that one if you can. And then in the fall, we'll be having two last call webinars. And those will almost serve as office hours. So you can come and bring your questions if I'm sure I'll be talking to a lot of you on the phone or over email, but you can also join in on that webinar and kind of hear what everyone else has to say and what they're doing as they're going through the application process. So a first note is actually that anyone listening in who's familiar with the application or has completed it in a past cycle, you'll see that we have a brand new application system this year, and it's called Slate. It's been great. It's really easy to use. You'll see that the it all remains the same. So you will see, though, upon starting an application that what you see on the screen here, there are some shorter application sections in which you're really just entering text and using drop-downs. And then I'll get into, in a minute, where you'll be uploading a number of documents. So one tip that we like to give is that it's always very helpful, we find, for institutions to start the application early and to really get a look at what's being asked of them, how it's being asked, and just to really get a sense of all of the components. So I'd also encourage you to take a look at the Scholar in Residence application guidelines, which Sarah will link to in this PowerPoint when it's published later. And those application guidelines I am always pointing to in advising calls and in emails because they really do give such a great in-depth look at all of the components, best practices and tips kind of for just walking through the application itself. But yes, back to the slide is this these are the first sections of the application. It's more basic. You're really just writing in names and contact information in text boxes. To highlight a few pieces, you'll see that there are two contacts listed here. One of them is the administrative official, so that's anyone who can sign off on affiliation information. And then the other is the principal contact for academic arrangements. For both of these contacts, we defer to you as to how your institution is made up and determine who the appropriate individual is. Sometimes this might be the same person. Sometimes one might be the president. Another time it might be a department head. So again, this is just really up to you and what works for your school. And then regarding program dates, I know Sarah had mentioned this, but we are working pretty far in advance, and you're actually listing dates in the 2020 and 2021 academic year. And then we'll be discussing financial support and then named versus recruited scholars in a moment, but in this section, you're just listing the basic information. And then lastly, there's a proposal summary. That gives our reviewers a snapshot as to what your program entails. So it's really helpful if you use this section to highlight all major pieces that you want the reviewers to see. And then the next slide there, Sarah, is the narrative proposal. So at the end of this and the next section, Amanda, I might be picking your brain a little bit as someone who has completed the application. So just a warning for you here. yes. So now we are getting into this next section. It's called the narrative. This is divided into two parts. So you'll see we have part one at the top of this slide here. So first we have the institutional profile. It's 4 to 5 pages, or 7 to 8 if how Sarah had talked about that joint proposal. So you're doubling the institutions, doubling the number of pages. Keep in mind here that the reviewers may or may not know your institution. So this section is really key to giving them a better idea of your institution and who you are. So things you'll include in this institution profile section include just general institution information, as listed on the screen here. And I will say that we've seen that it's often helpful for applicants to just break down these pages by section. So slotting in a few paragraphs under the mission heading, under academic offerings heading, and then kind of on down the line with these categories. What we do mainly want to see is how your institution is set up, what you have in place, and also what you don't have in place on campus that an SIR could potentially help with. This is also where you'll be indicating your institution's short and long-term goals and objectives. So what are you hoping to gain through internationalizing your campus and efforts, and how specifically would hosting a scholar in residence fit into these goals? So David, first I want to hand it to you to see if you have anything to add for the first part of the narrative proposal.
I guess my general advice, which maybe won't be surprising, is, as Kaylee said, if you go through this step by step and look at each piece, I think the biggest reason why a proposal isn't funded, isn't recommended for funding, is because people have not paid enough attention to each of the pieces. Maybe they've addressed one piece well, but they've in terms of what the scholar might do, let's say, on campus, what their teaching load will be, and so forth. Maybe they have not said enough about what the engagement might be within the surrounding community. And we look at proposal as a set of pieces, so it's really important that you address each of the pieces.
Yeah. And then, Amanda, your experience with completing this part, and in the next section I'll be talking about the program itself, so you can hold any advice if you want. But, yeah, very curious to hear what you'd have to say here.
And I think one of the things that I wanted to say, and I kind of want to echo what David said, what really helped us is breaking down that narrative into sections, because for us that kind of made us look at everything and made us look at what we have to write down. And so literally before we ever even started, we took the application and we took all of those sections and made them into headlines, and that kind of became the skeleton of the proposal, because that really helped us make sure that we were getting all the information in that we needed. And the other thing, too, is when you mentioned, talking about the institution and knowing that maybe not everybody knows who you are, we kind of write it from the point of view that we're talking to someone who has no idea where Powell, Wyoming is, who has no idea what Northwest College is. And so even though, instinctively we may think, everybody knows this or everybody knows that, we kind of take ourselves out of that mindset and we literally, write down who we are, where we are, what our demographics are, because that really helps us kind of explain then later on what the need is for a Fulbright.
And as Sarah said, I could not have said that better myself. I think that is just case in point for what we've seen in successful applications through the years of kind of your approach, Amanda, to completing this application. And I know that sometimes it's one person completing a preliminary version of the application. Other times it's a number of people in a document working together on it. So I've heard in both cases that it's helpful to kind of break it out in sections in that way. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. And then the next section, Sarah, is part two. So again, Amanda, I'll be asking for your feedback at the end. But the second part of the narrative proposal is really where you show what the Scholar in Residence program is trying to accomplish for you. So within, for example, the oversight section here, you're addressing who on campus will be responsible and for what during the entirety of the visit or the proposed visit. So you actually already have two contacts identified in that first part of the application that I mentioned, where it's just text boxes, that kind of thing. So those were the administrative official and the faculty associate. So in this section here, though, in the narrative part two, you can actually provide a nice background of those individuals and what they'll be doing for the scholar on campus. So we've seen the oversight section take various forms. There could be a few faculty or staff listed here. There could be a whole Fulbright steering committee that engages staff from other departments or other backgrounds. Again, it's all really dependent on your college or your university. So we just want to see what thought has been put into the scholars program on campus and that they and you as the host will be set up for success. Then we have the academic program of the scholar. So here you talk about what qualifications or background the scholar should have to meet the proposal's needs, then jump into the need for the courses themselves even. We often get a question about how many courses a scholar might teach on campus, and we see on average about two per semester. Sometimes the scholar might be teaching a course that's already designed and just providing international insight into that curriculum on the U.S. campus. And then other times they might actually be creating an entirely new course. So highlighting this is important to reviewers to understand the amount of preparation that goes into what the scholar needs to do to complete these activities. And again, just be sure to discuss how the scholar would interact all across campus, even across the community. This should show that you've thought through how to maximize the scholar's time and presence in your whole community. And for example, on the screen right now, we have Jairo from Costa Rica who went to Harper College, which is a community college in Illinois, and I hope I'm getting that right. And there, he's engaging here with a local elementary school. So just really showing, and we'll be talking about letters of support in a minute, but just really highlighting any and all opportunities that the scholar has to engage with the larger community is great. And then we had mentioned before for professional enrichment here that the application and the program is institutionally driven, but we do also want to see that there's potential for the scholar's growth. So if you plan to include them in faculty meetings, orientations, attending conferences, anything like that, just make sure that you're highlighting it also. As for sustainability, we would just say to focus on how you would sustain the scholars' activities after they leave. So David, did you have any insight about some creative, sustainable options that you've seen through the years?
Sure. A couple examples. We often hear that the scholar, once they return home, might do some online courses for you after they returned home. We've seen a number of cases where, based on the relationship that you've developed with your scholar, you end up doing some kind of student exchange or faculty exchange with his or her home school. You know, we've seen connections made between local communities. I remember a case where the scholar returned home and he was teaching in the economics field, and created a sort of a city relationship in a sense between his home and host cities, sort of a mini chamber of commerce. Think of ways that you could sustain the benefits that the scholar has brought to you. Maybe the scholar designed a course that was begun for the first time when the scholar was with you. Maybe that course is then continued on an ongoing basis after the scholar returns. So there's various ways to think about maintaining the relationship and building upon what the scholar contributed to your campus while they were there.
Yeah, and in the sustainability section especially, you'll start to see that all of the components of the application are kind of combined. So how David was talking about the benefits of the program earlier, a lot of that are these sustainability pieces in action, and the same with the long and short-term goals. So thank you, David, for that insight there too. And then I'd say the last piece I wanted to touch on here is the financial support. So here you'll be taking amounts that you had just input in that previous section that I was talking about with the text boxes. So, and you'll actually be expanding on what cost share you're able to provide in this narrative section of the application. We say that cost share is encouraged, and institutions are asked to think creatively of ways that they can provide it, but it's not required. It won't make or break an application. You won't be disqualified if you can't provide any cost share. We have seen it take the form of salary supplement or in-kind support. So we've seen institutions offer meal plans on campus, defraying the cost of housing or providing housing. Same with transportation, maybe even auditing classes. So here's where you'll actually be providing estimates as to what those in-kind supports are valued at, and anything else that you might be able to include in this section also. And again, David, did you have anything to add for this support section?
I would add also that so we think about this in terms of potential of an actual salary supplement in cash to augment the Fulbright. If you can't do that, which we understand lots of schools can't, then also think about ways that you might be able to provide, as Kaylee's talking about, the different kinds of in-kind support. The other thing I would mention is, for those of you that are minority-serving institutions, you should realize that, in fact, it may be feasible for you to provide and you'll know whether you have Title III or Title V funding through the U.S. Department of Education. It may be feasible for you to use those funds both in, as a salary supplement in terms of cash or purchasing other kinds of things that might be considered then in kind as a way of augmenting the Fulbright. So I just mentioned that because not everybody realizes that, in fact, that's another funding stream that might be available to you.
Mm-hmm. And then amount, too. Is there anything that we typically see?
I think it varies widely. You know, in a given year, we'll see everything from zero to $50,000. In the case of $50,000, the salary supplement was more than the Fulbright. I mean, that's not happening often, obviously, but the point is that you see a huge range. A number of schools are able to provide some kind of salary supplement, which is great, but other schools might not be able to do that. And we understand that every school is in a certain situation, so it really would depend on your own circumstances that will dictate whether you can or can't provide that kind of support.
All right, great. Thank you, David. And then, Amanda, you might be talking about a lot of this later, so feel free to just say that you'll be addressing this part later on, but if you have anything to add here, happy to hear from you again.
I will talk a lot about this later on, but the one thing I want to say with this part is just like with the first part, we literally took all those headlines and we wrote them down, and then we kind of looked at what we could do to meet each and every one of those headlines, and I think it made it much easier that way. And I think for this part too, just for us, you know, this is the part where you can be creative. I mean, Fulbright really offers an opportunity, especially for smaller institutions like ours, to kind of fill those voids and to help us reach those greater missions and dreams that we want to. So I think this is kind of the part where you can start thinking about that and seeing what a Fulbright scholar really can do for your campus and your community. So, you know, be creative in this section.
And thanks again, Amanda. Okay. So, Sarah, the next. Okay. So, after the narrative portion, we would want to hear, and again, this is still in that uploads section of the application, but we want to hear more about the scholar that you wish to bring. So, the program allows for two different tracks that you can see here. You can either name a scholar or ask for recruitment of a scholar. For naming, you can name a scholar in your proposal that maybe faculty has worked with in the past. If you do name, then outline why that particular scholar best fits your particular grant. We'd ask you to submit a CV, two letters of recommendation. One should speak to the scholar's teaching ability since they're coming to your campus to undertake primarily teaching. And then you'll also, of course, want to make sure that they have the required English skills to teach that topic on campus. And if you don't have a specific scholar in mind or have those connections with someone that would meet your proposal's needs, then that is no problem. You can request the recruitment of a scholar. If you go down this route, then you'll be able to choose two different countries within one world region. These are all listed on our website. We can point you to them if you need to take a look. And in the proposal, you'll actually include information about the type of scholar that you'd like for us to recruit. So we actually use these details that you provide here to reach out to our colleagues abroad and see if they'd be able to recruit a scholar within that discipline or specialization that you're requesting. We ask that you outline the credentials of the scholar and if there's a certain amount of teaching experience that they might need to teach on your campus, if there's any degree requirements that they need. Really anything that helps us to narrow down the recruitment efforts. We often do get questions about if your chances of receiving a scholar in residence grant are better if you name or versus recruit a scholar. So David, did you want to take this one of naming versus recruitment?
Sure. We do get the question fairly often, and I would say the majority of proposals that come in fact, are asking for a scholar by name. But having said that, there's no preference whatsoever. It's whatever meets your your needs and your situation. The one thing I would say, if you're asking us to recruit for you, to think about specifically sort of how you're discussing the scholar that you would like, and be a bit flexible. You know, if you're looking at a scholar, you know, you might have a scholar by name that you'd want someone to come teach history. If you are actually asking for a scholar to be recruited, think about could we be a little more flexible and maybe say social sciences, for example, rather than just history, which then makes it a bit easier for the Fulbright Commission or the U.S. Embassy that's doing that recruitment to find a scholar that can meet your needs. Or maybe you say, we'd like history or economics or history or political science. In other words, be a bit flexible in terms of what you think you might be able to accommodate on your campus in terms of your needs.
Yeah. All right. Great. And then I think that later on we'll be hearing from Amanda about that too, about which route they've chosen. Okay. So then moving on to the next section here, these are more of the supplemental materials. So these are still within that upload section of the application. So I had mentioned these earlier, the letters of support. These letters would directly relate to your institution and what you're applying to do. At a minimum, there should be a letter from the administrative official and just confirming that, yes, you can welcome a scholar on campus. And there is no maximum, so you can seek out letters from different departments across your institution, even neighboring institutions, local elementary schools, as we saw with Harper College in that previous slide. I'll say that including a letter of support is not setting it in stone. It's not saying, yes, we will work with this group or this department when the scholar is here. It's just really showcasing the excitement of having that scholar in residence on your campus. And kind of in the reverse, this can also grow once the scholar arrives, so you're not bound only to the letters of support that you're providing here. As for the sample syllabi and course outlines, what we'd like to see is that the proposed courses really give a sense of what the course is about, and if you're naming a scholar, you might have insight into what they're able to teach and craft it in a way that really enhances their cultural perspective. But if you didn't name a scholar, if you're asking for scholar recruitment, then you're also able to say in this section what you'd want that scholar to be able to do and be able to teach and be able to bring to the classroom. With all of these, we understand that things may change, so this really is just a sample and not the be-all and end-all of the course syllabi, too. Okay, and then moving on to the review criteria. Once you move forward with the application, you might be curious as to what the external review committee is looking for during review. And we've been saying this throughout, but just really make sure that all of the pieces of the application are working together. And just really giving the reviewers a picture of what you're hoping to accomplish through hosting a scholar in residence. So these are your short-term and long-term goals, and this is how hosting a scholar in residence would contribute to those goals. Again, we already discussed most of these when actually running through the application components, so to just hone in on a few pieces here, you'll want to think through if the proposal is feasible within the time period. You'll want to expand as much as possible on the types of community outreach and engagement, along with creating a network across the institution for that scholar to take advantage of. And then take the time to think through that sustainability element. So are other professors sitting in on the classrooms and learning about what the scholar is teaching to try to help to sustain it? And again, we'll be hearing, I think, from Amanda in a moment about seeing these pieces in action and how it's been for her through this process, too. And then, Sarah, I think I'm handing it back to you for the
pop-up. Perfect. Thanks, Kaylee. So quickly, before we do pass the reins over to Amanda, we want to let you guys know a quick overview of the timeline and the review process. So one special thing that this program does offer, and I know we've mentioned it a bit, is you are allowed to submit a draft proposal about 1 month before the actual deadline. So the deadline is November 1st of 2019. So you have up until October 1st of 2019 to submit a draft proposal. And what that means is you can send it to us early. We'll take a look at it and write some critical feedback for you to enhance your application. That's one thing that you don't get that hands-on opportunity on every program. So it's a value added that we want to give to you because we want to see you be successful in your application process. So as of November 1st, that is the deadline for your applications. In November, our team conducts a technical review for completeness. We'll follow up if anything is missing or you happen to upload a blank page instead of the actual document that you wanted, or a photo of a nice dog or something, we'll follow up with you if there's any glaring errors in your application.
That would be great, though,
Sarah. No, great. It would be so wonderful to have a dog photo, but no, please don't submit them. So please feel free to know we're not trying to throw your application out. We will follow up if there's any errors so your application does come forth as you had intended it to. In December, we will have our external review meeting. That's where a team of former hosts will sit together, they'll review the proposals, and they will make their selection of who they think should receive the grant this year, who might be an alternate, so on and so forth. Then in January, you will be notified of the review outcome that happened in December. And then a few things kind of are all happening in sync. From January to February, Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, ECA, and the J. Williams Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board, which is often known as FFSB, will actually review those recommended proposals. And while they're reviewing that and giving their sign-off, IIE will confirm the institutional funding to make sure that all of the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. While that is happening, we will be working with our counterparts overseas at either the commissions or the U.S. embassies to confirm the scholars. So as Kaylee said, you can either name or request recruitment of a scholar. So if you name the scholar, we'll be working with that scholar's home country to confirm that they can accept that award. And then if you have requested recruitment, we'll work again with that home country overseas for them to recruit and find a scholar that meets your needs, which we'll provide back for you, and you ultimately get that choice of who you wish to invite to your campus. So all of that is happening kind of in concert with each other. So it's a busy time over here at IIE. And then from April to June, we will be sending those grant packets to those grantees ahead of their start dates for either the fall or the following spring of the 2020-2021 academic year. Lastly, Kaylee pointed out a lot of great resources that we do have available. I will be linking most of these resources in the follow-up email once this webinar is recorded. I'll be linking you guys to a bunch of these opportunities, and again, you can see on this screen the draft proposal deadline is October 1st. If you do want to review it, we have great scholar stories and examples on our website as well. So again, we want to make you guys successful. We want to give you all the tools possible, so please feel free to utilize these. And with that, it is my extreme pleasure to pass the reins over to Amanda. So Amanda, would you like to take the reins?
Yes, sure. Thank you so much. So again, my name is Amanda Enriquez, and I'm the Intercultural Program Manager at Northwest College in Powell, Wyoming. And if we could go to the next slide. Northwest College, we're located about 25 miles from Cody and about 90 miles from Billings. So really, we're what we like to say in the middle of nowhere. We're about 90 miles outside of Yellowstone National Park. We're a small town, so our population is about 6,407, and we're predominantly white, which makes it, in terms of diversity, you know, a challenge. We're not very diverse. But at the same time, really, this makes this Fulbright an opportunity for us because we need to start building that diversity, not just on our campus, but also in our community. our student population. We're at about 1,600 students, most of them from the state of Wyoming. Most of our students have never traveled outside of our state, and they definitely have never been abroad anywhere. So again, you know, building that diversity has always been key for us. We have about 50 international students, which is about 4% of our total population. And we had our third Fulbright Scholar on campus last year. And we're excited that we're expecting another Fulbright next year. And we've done both. So we've actually named, this time around, we named a scholar. This particular scholar actually reached out to us, and after talking to her back and forth and figuring out what her goals are and what our goals were as an institution, we decided to move forward with that. But our previous scholars were all recruited by Fulbright. So we've done both, and it's been the process in terms of writing the application, I feel, didn't change much, because you still need to know who you are as an institution and what your short-term goals are and long-term goals. And then it just kind of changed a little bit with naming a scholar. I think it was a little bit easier for us to really look at who our partners were going to become and what kinds of presentations she could do within the community or even the surrounding communities, where when you have a scholar recruited, sometimes those needed to be a little bit more broad. And then I think on the next slide, for us, the opportunities to get a Fulbright Scholar, first and foremost, we're a small community college, so we're a two-person office, and we do everything from recruitment to admissions to retention, academic, immigration advising, all of that. And so we've really been trying to figure out how to expand that, and it's not just about bringing international students to campus, but how can we give back to our community, and how can we start internationalizing our campus and kind of start changing that mindset of, you know, our faculty need to be just as diverse as our population, and our state needs to be more diverse, our community needs to be more diverse. And so really, this Fulbright program is a way for us to internationalize the campus and the community beyond just bringing international students to our campus. Events and programming, we really do a lot with our students in terms of programs. We do about one or two programs a week with our students to try to get them out into the community. And having someone like a Fulbright Scholar allows us to kind of expand on that programming and bringing in a whole different audience to the table and to become supporters of our program that otherwise we would have never been able to have. For example, this time around, our scholar that we're going to have next year, I mean, her passion and her kind of her academia is all around energy and clean energy and economics and how that builds in. And that was perfect for us because that's one of the things that our state is moving towards in terms of diversifying our economy. And so with this go around, for example, one of the partners that we worked with was the local Chamber of Commerce, and, you know, and really, how can we bring in this scholar and then get her to talk to our community and work with entities outside of our campus, which then in turn, which is huge for us, is the increased visibility of our program. We have believed strongly over the years that one of the ways that we can gain more support and that we can make ourselves more visible is by being out there. And so with this Fulbright Scholar and with the ones in the past too, it's really a way for us to kind of build that visibility and to let the administration know and the campus and the community that international education and these global partnerships, they're here to stay, and they're not just one of those things that we talk about and then we can just ignore it. And so we really try to incorporate the newspaper. We have feature stories written. We do receptions for our scholars. We, you know, make sure that they're announced at our all-campus emails and that literally, we kind of built this hype around the Scholar just to let people know how truly special it is that we have someone here. Challenges, we've had a lot of challenges, of course, but some of them are collaborating with a department or a division. Again, because we're small and sometimes we don't have a lot of resources, people don't even think outside the box. And so a lot of what we've had to do is find a way to convince a department that this is really what they need and that this is what can help them just as much as it can help us. And so, for example, for us, one of the things that we have done is to try to tell faculty that, look, this is someone that can help, you know, come and teach in your department, build up your department, do some of the projects that otherwise would never get done. And so, but for us, that's taken some time because we've really had to work with the division chairs and the department chairs to kind of try to help them understand how this can fit into their curriculum. And then getting the whole campus on the same page. This has been probably one of the most difficult things for us to do, but it's also been one of the best things for us because it's really allowed us to come together as a campus. Because initially, it feels like we're such separated entities that, you know, you get one thing from HR, but then you get another thing from computer services. And this happened to us with our last Scholar. We did everything. We brought her in, and then she got here, and we tried to log her onto the computer, and then this whole thing came about how they weren't quite sure, was she a visiting instructor, or was she a faculty member, or what the label was, and so then it became like this huge issue, and so then that really taught us that in one way, it was really great that it opened up this whole can of worms because it allowed us to work together. But at the same time, those are some of the things that I think you have to keep in mind because for us, we waited until our Scholar was on campus to figure those things out and realize that they were challenges. And so, but she was great and she was flexible and she, you know, and she was really good to work with. And so it wasn't really an issue, but it was something that we had to work out with. The pre-communication arrival, I think for me, that has been one of the biggest lessons that I've learned and one of the biggest things that I've had to make sure. Powell, we had our Fulbright Scholar arrive from Africa in the middle of the winter. It was dark, it was snowing, and while we had told her that we had winters in Wyoming, she didn't realize just how cold it would get. And so when her and her daughter arrived, I mean, neither one of them had jackets and neither one of them had snow boots. And then they came in on a late flight and nothing was open. There were no restaurants, no grocery store where they could get some food. And so we worked around it again because, you know, we made sure we fed them and everything. But those are some of the things that I think now moving forward are things that I know that I need to tell them. Public transportation, we don't have public transportation in Powell. So for us, unless you have a car, you're walking. And if it's in the middle of the winter and it's below zero and wind chills are in the negative 20s or 30s, you might not want to have your Scholar walking around everywhere. So those are just some of the things that, you know, the more upfront you can be, I think the better your Scholars can prepare themselves, and then that's one less thing that's going to hit them when they arrive. And then look at your need as an institution, which for us has been a challenge because, again, international education is never in the forefront of anyone. And so we have had to find a way to bring that to them. Classroom opportunities. You know, I think this is great, especially for rural institutions. We can go to the next slide. That was great. For us, we're smaller class sizes, and so students and faculty can really engage. And so for us, that's an opportunity that we tell our Scholars is that they can come here, they can teach, they can really get to know the students and the faculty. But again, the challenges are, you know, the program adjustment, the last minute changes. I think we've had that with pretty much every single one of our scholars when suddenly someone decides that, oh, we need this class filled or, you know, or this is open. And so we've really had to work with our faculty and our administration to make sure that we can work through these. Community opportunities, this for us is huge. So again, we really try to find a way of how can our scholar help us achieve that greater mission of building diversity. And one of the things that we really do is how can we get them engaged with the community. And so we try to get them into as many classrooms as possible. And sometimes it's not even related specifically with what their CV is, but, you know, for if our Fulbright scholar was a female, then we had her present for Women's History Month, International Education Week, and it could be talking about their country if they don't want to talk about their research. Finding anyone and everyone who will work with you in the community. And so for us, like our Chamber of Commerce, our schools, our senior citizen centers, our churches, our local museums, our high schools, like we literally go around and try to see how does that fit in and what we can do to kind of broaden that diversity and start building that awareness. And I think we can go to the next slide. And so, again, you know, possible challenges to kind of look at when you're bringing someone, especially to a rural institution, small, 2 years, is the engagement. So for us, you know, when someone hears Powell, Wyoming, the first instinct or the first thing they'll say is, well, there's nothing to do, I'm bored, you know. And so we really try to make sure that our scholar is engaged in as many activities as possible. And again, you know, this is your, look at this as a way to be creative. Look at this as a way to kind of put yourself on the map, because this really is one of your chances to internationalize your campus and your community. So capitalize on that. So for us, like our scholar, we have her sit on committees, the Diversity Awareness Committee, the Internationalization Advisory Committee. We have her be an advisor of the Multicultural Club. We have her be on the Intercultural House Committee. So anything that we can find that will fit and that scholar would like to do, we have them do it. Flexibility, you have to be flexible and adaptable. I think with our scholars, you know, we've tried, I meet with them on a weekly basis just to make sure that they have everything that they need, that they're liking what they're doing, you know, and then kind of also build, because I want to make sure that they're getting something out of this opportunity as much as we are. So I want to make sure that they're getting the professional development that they needing. And so with like our previous scholar, for example, like halfway throughout the semester, she came to me and she said, I really want to do this. And I said, great, so let's start looking to see how we can do that. And then she came to me earlier and said, you know, this is really not working for me. And we said, great, let's see how we can fix that. So, but unless you have that communication with your scholar, you really can't figure out what's working and what's not. So, you know, really make sure that whoever that person is that's in charge knows, you know, and communicates. And then work with your institution. Again, I talked about that a little before, but make sure that people are aware that there's a scholar on campus. You know, make sure that the community knows, and preferably ahead of time so that you can avoid some of those challenges that we went through. And then, you know, make sure that you and your scholar keep an open mind. Small towns were quite different from bigger cities. So, I mentioned this before. We have no public transportation. We have limited restaurants, limited shopping. Weather for us is a factor, and so, you know, for us, for the students and the scholar, we include the scholar with our students. So like every other weekend we do trips to the surrounding communities. We take them shopping. We provide rides every now and then when the weather is really bad. So again, just kind of being there and helping your scholar get through with everything. And I think that was pretty much it. We can move to the next slide. And so just to kind of, as a last minute, you know, for all the institutions out there, just know that this is an opportunity and look at it as an opportunity and be creative, because I think for us this has really been a way that we can put ourselves on the map and internationalize our community and our campus. So I think that's it for me.
Thank you, Amanda. And I know, everyone, that we are a little bit short on time, so thanks for sticking with us for a few more minutes here. But Amanda, I think that just hearing from you kind of on that more broad level of even talking about named versus recruited scholars, I know that when writing the application, I've heard it can be tricky to kind of walk that line between, like, how do you approach this topic for a named scholar versus a recruited? So our team at SIR@IIU.org, we're happy to answer questions and to just kind of help think through that process. Amanda, hearing about these, but also on a more broad level, like taking a step back and looking at outcomes in these larger, in these meetings that you were including your scholars in, it's just really great to hear. I also personally really like hearing about these day-to-day issues that that some hosts have when welcoming the scholars on campus, because these are things that everyone has to think about, is that laptop issue and how to get the scholar around on campus and how to address certain pieces with them. So just really thank you again for talking through all of these pieces from your side. I think that it goes a really long way in kind of helping to guide the next round of applications that we'll hopefully be seeing from the rural colleges. And then also with these more logistical pieces, I think that Sarah will be talking in a second about the Outreach Lecturing Fund. And just kind of any and all preparation that you can do going into having the scholar on campus is just so helpful, and just trying to get everything set up beforehand. And Sarah, I think that you might be able to talk about that a little bit more in terms of the Outreach Lecturing Fund.
Yes. Before we segue to that, it is the next slide, I promise. Kaylee spoke about upcoming webinars. They're all on our website as well as the CIES.org homepage. As I send those out, you can also click these links, but we do have three upcoming webinars, and obviously we're happy to set up individual advising appointments around these times as well. And then, as Kaylee was saying, we do have the Outreach Lecturing Fund through Fulbright. This allows you as an institution on a smaller scale than Scholar in Residence, but it also works in conjunction with Scholar in Residence, but allows you as a host institution to apply to bring current visiting scholars already in the U.S. to your campus for short-term lectureships of 2 to 6 days. Obviously, if you do apply and you receive an SIR, encourage your SIR to go on the OLF as well. And then you can also host other scholars to come to your campus, and perhaps they can also interact with the scholar that you are hosting. So really the sky is the limit for that. This program is also seeking institutions just like the Scholar in Residence program, so we're really looking for minority-serving institutions, community colleges, small liberal arts, rural colleges, women's colleges, so on and so forth. Effectively, this program is a travel grant, so you apply a month in advance. We will pay the travel to get the scholar to your institution. If your institution cannot provide the funding to house the scholar, all you have to do is request supplemental funding, and we can take it from there on a case-by-case basis. But if anyone has any questions, feel free to email me at olf@iie.org. And with that, I think we can quickly dive through a few of these questions. First off the bat, this session is being recorded. We will email out the recording and the PowerPoint presentation to everyone who registers, so you will get that email directly from us. And then I do see some statements coming through for you, Amanda, just really thanking you for the detailed analysis that you gave in regards to thinking through things such as climate, culture, food, clothing, that they just never even thought about. So thank you so much for that expertise. Kaylee, did you see any other questions that were standing out to you?
Yeah, so just a few, and again, I know we're short on time. So someone was asking about teaching and research ratios. To this, I'd say that this program is a little bit different than some of the other typical Fulbright programs that you might have applied to or worked with in the past. This is primarily undergraduate teaching that the scholar would be expected to do on campus, but as we've kind of dove into through this whole presentation, there are many, many other opportunities for engagement and other ways for the scholar to work with your campus. So if you have specific questions about that, feel free to reach out to us and we can help. And then we also have a question about, I'm just reading it really quickly. So it's about if you have a faculty member who is off campus for a period of time, would you be able to host apply to host a scholar in residence to fill that gap while that faculty is gone? To that, I'd say that it would need to be addressed in a number of ways throughout the application just to make sure that the scholar in residence is meeting the other goals of the program, so engaging with the campus and undertaking primarily undergraduate teaching and meeting your hosts, you as the host, your short and long-term goals, everything like that. It could also come into play with the actual courses that the scholar is teaching. So if you have a specific scholar in mind versus recruiting, we would just need to know a lot of details about any specific courses that a scholar would be expected to teach. And again, there would also be a need for flexibility because, as we've been saying, things change, and we definitely recognize that. So, David, I don't know if you wanted to address that at all to the kind of taking over a faculty member's coursework while they're gone or something along those lines, if we've seen that in the past.
I think we do see it on occasion. I think that can work. And I think the issues that you raised, Kaylee, were right. You know, it needs to be part of a larger process, a bigger process. The kinds of things that the scholar would be doing beyond teaching need to be addressed. The other question I would ask is, if you're having a scholar come in simply to replace another scholar, then are you still concentrating on the things like sustainability and that scholar when they go home, where you're still engaging with them? So, you know, while we see it could be used as someone coming in to replace a scholar who's off campus, there are a number of other questions and objectives that need to be made for the SIR to really, to exist the way it should exist in terms of a full-blown connection between the scholar, the campus, and the community.
Agreed. And I'd also say, looking at those application guidelines that we have published, those can also kind of help to think through how your exact situation could apply to the scholar and resident application. Okay. And I think we do have a few more questions, but just a lot of thanks and congratulations on there to both Amanda and to David. But yeah, Sarah, did you want to take a look at anything else? If not, I think we might be able to finish up.
Yeah, one question that comes in year in and year out, and I thought we addressed this on the website, but we'll have to look into, but it was about a proposal, double and single spaced, if we had any preference. Kaylee, do you remember what came up of this in the past?
I say double.
we'll make sure to put that on the website if it's not already there. But for the other questions, we'll feel free to email us, but we'll also reach out. But yes, please feel free to reach out to us. And we do hope you guys, there's a lot of interest in this application, so we hope you apply. But first of all, I just really want to thank everyone who took the time to attend today, as well as to the panelists today. So to Amanda and David, thank you so much for being here. And David, you are getting congratulations for your award at NAFSA.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
So your name does precede you, so this is great. But again, I don't know, David or Amanda, if you have any closing statements, but that is all from our end.
I just want to say thank you.
Go ahead, please.
No, just thank you, everyone, for being here, and thank you for having me. I really enjoy doing this, so. Mm-hmm.
And I would just add that I think you can tell from all of us that we're maybe a bit biased, but we think this program really is special and really does fill a unique role in terms of what Fullback can do. So we really hope that you're enthused by what you've heard and that you really think about applying and take advantage of the future webinars and the opportunity to have your proposal draft reviewed and so forth. We're trying to make this user-friendly and want to help you, you know, as much as we can. So thank you very much.
All right. Well, everyone take care and have a good rest of the week and a good weekend. And, again, thank you all for joining.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.